Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast. And today's guest is none other than Damjan Rudeš. Damjan is a former NBA player as well as former Croatian national team player. And today we talked a lot about his career as a shooter. We talked about slumps. We talked about his workout that he felt the most pressure on, and that was a make or break moment for him. I'm spoiler alert. We also talked about his Sunset Sports Festival that he's organizing, how he ventured into the business aspect of the sport and not into coaching. We talked about the fork in the road where he had to make a decision which way to go. We talked about the retirement process as well, how he went through it and how he approached retirement himself, and lots of other topics that you're going to enjoy. Please tune in. Please subscribe to this podcast. Lots more content coming, and see you soon. Thanks for being here. Bye. Damjan, welcome to my world.
Thank you so much for inviting me, my friend. It's a pleasure to be here.
We made it. We finally made it.
Yeah, we did. It's been 2.5 years since we started talking about me jumping on the podcast. And then, you know, with the crazy schedules, we finally made it.
Yeah, that's the basketball world we live in. It's just always kind of always on the go, always in one country, out the other. And it's the never ending blur of travels.
Plus, now you're a champ, man, so you're not an easy guy to get to, you know what I mean? I can officially congratulate
on
winning the championship. I love your Instagram feed. It's always, you know, some new photos keep popping up, and it always makes me happy. So
new old photos. Yeah, I'm going to keep reminding people.
Don't stop. Don't ever stop.
No, you're the champion until you're dethroned. So I have 1 year of just and then we repeat, and then I repeat the cycle again.
New photos and new cycle. Fantastic.
New photos, new cycle, old photos. I mean, I'm just going to keep going until somebody is just, I mean, people are going to cancel me, probably.
No reason to stop, man. So well deserved. And I'm sure people are very happy for you. And, you know, it's I'm sure it's a phenomenal feeling.
Thank you. Do you think back on when you won championships in I believe in Croatia and Slovenia, you won the domestic championships?
Yeah, Belgium as well.
Belgium as well.
Yeah, lost a couple of tight ones, unfortunately. But yeah, winning a championship is so special. But I don't think anything can compare to winning an NBA title. I mean, I think that's on a whole nother level. But yeah, we had some great, you know, feelings and great parties after winning our championships. And, you know, it's always nice, especially if you contribute, and then it's a good feeling. But just watching all the footage of, you know, winning an NBA title, it just feels surreal. I think, you know, even just imagining being there and having all those people chant for you and being on the world stage. I mean, just looking at all the stuff you posted, it's, you know, it's really phenomenal.
It's amazing. And it's one thing, you know, it's another gratification, feeling of gratification when you're actually the whole time with the team. You know, it's different for me. I have a different role. So it's kind of, it's not comparable to a regular, let's say, an assistant coach or a staff member or a player who's constantly like, you know what I mean? Like the bond that you build throughout the season is completely different. And the feeling, the reward you get being on the floor, the time is ticking down. You just, you know, like you get a rush of adrenaline. I remember with the national team, with CSKA, with any, like you get, it's anticipation of the season or finally being over at the pinnacle, you know, and it's just, everything is just raining down, all emotions let flow. Because the thing that you do as athletes, as coaches, high level performers, you have to keep a lid on the emotions. You have to keep a, even if you're up 3-1, you got to keep the lid on and make stay on course, because you're so close to it. You feel like, oh, we're right there.
We're there.
But you're not, you know, you're not there until you're there. And it's so many times that it happened where you just kind of, I've been there too. I mean, we let the lid off with the national team when we made it to the final, and then we don't have the energy, the mental energy more than physical, the mental energy, the emotional to persevere over the tough times in the final. And you got to stay locked in. Have you had those moments also?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once you enter those last phases, it's all, I mean, everyone is tired physically. So it just goes down to the mental game, right? And it's that 1% that you have against your opponent and the capability to kind of keep the lid on the emotions and to stay mentally focused. I saw it now a couple of times during the Olympics. You know, you see it in different sports as well. Like people are up, like our tennis player, Donna Vekic, she was up in the semifinals and, you know, she was up 5-0 with, you know, and won the first set. And she almost, you know, you could tell on her face, she was starting to celebrate a little bit. She was kind of like, oh, I got this. And, you know, I was grabbing my head. I was like, oh my God, like, this is not good. You know, even in tennis, like any tennis match can go, you know, it can turn around, and you know, like basketball. That. So you see it in different sports as well. But yeah, I've definitely been in some situations. You know, in Monaco, we played the finals of the French league. You know, and we had a home court advantage. We played against Le Mans, who wasn't really ranked as high as we thought they would be. They made it to the finals. You know, phenomenal team led by Romeo Travis, who ended up being the MVP. And we kind of thought like, oh, you know, we got this. We're good. And then boom, you know, you lose the last game on the home court in Monaco. It kind of, you know, leaves a bitter taste in your mouth. But it ends up being a mental game, really. And you can tell by the way guys enter the locker room. You can tell by the guy, you know, guys' behavior, how everyone is, you know, saying hi. Is everyone focused? The way people tie their shoelaces, the way people, you know, look at the rim, the way they breathe. I mean, you know, the little things that come into, you know, it all adds up. It all adds up. It can't really be, it's not over till it's over, right? Like the Kobe quote, the job is not done.
The job is not done.
Until the final whistle. And that's, it's not for everyone. It's really not for everyone. You know,
people forget. People forget it's competitors. They're everybody, yeah. All of them are competitors. And I was talking, because through the past 2013, 2015, we won in the semi and we lost with the national team and we lost in the final. And 13 actually was against Croatia when we won in the semifinals.
We have to talk about that game?
No. We'll just skip over that. But the thing is that when we won, I was talking to Coach Collet a year and a half ago. We had dinner together, and he was like, because France played after us, and mm-hmm. they saw us celebrate. And they saw how the flow of emotions you let out, everything is just there, and we are just made it to the final. And Tony told him, like, we got them. If we make it to the final, we got them.
Yeah.
And that's the experience that they had in 2011. They did the same thing in 2011 where they won in Lithuania in the semifinal, and then they lost in the final because of that. You know, they just let the emotions overflow. And you can't bring them back together. So it's a mix of experience and veteran leadership.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you could tell it by USA team last night. I mean, that last night against Serbia was one of the greatest basketball games I've ever watched in my life. Yeah. And I was actually surprised by the, you know, amount of celebration and lollygagging that was happening on the court by, you know, Team USA after the game. And you can tell that LeBron and the older guys were trying to round them up and be like, hey, one more and this and that. But a lot of guys were like, hey, they're really celebrating like they won, and now they got to play France in France, which is not going to be an easy task. So,
yeah,
I mean, it happens on every level, right? In every sport, and it's a momentum game. You lose that momentum, all of a sudden, a wave just goes over you, and you're nowhere. So, it's incredible how that mental aspect is the most important one.
Yeah, it's. We had that last year against when we beat the U.S. and we lost to Serbia also. It's something similar. And I believe it's hard because it's a hypothetical. If Serbia would have won against the U.S., it would have been twice as hard for them to win against France in the final, not only because it's France, but also because of the theoretical win against the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. You know, like we said, it all goes down to you know, the mental game. And, you know, France was celebrating as well. I wonder how France is going to react tomorrow. But that, I mean, just watching these games, you know, I've watched every single one of them, and you know, you pay attention to details, and the quality of basketball is just such an enjoyment to watch. It's really incredible. I mean, and you know, a lot of talk about the referees last night, but I wouldn't go there, man. I think the referees did a very, very good job, honestly. I mean, a call here and a call there, absolutely. But you know, you never had a feeling like the referees were drawing attention to themselves or like they were dictating the rhythm of the game. Very, very few instances, you know, which is, you know, admirable. And I think, you know, they let players do their thing. So I can't wait for, you know, for tomorrow's games. I think Serbia, Germany is going to be a war for the third place. And, you know, just that finals is going to be incredible. I mean, the strongest generation, I mean, strongest team possibly ever assembled, right? I mean,
it's the deepest Olympic basketball tournament that I've seen in terms of quality of depth in every team.
No doubt. I participated in the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, and that was, you know, there were some phenomenal players there, some phenomenal teams, but I think this is next level.
Yeah, I remember.
We actually played Lithuania.
I don't remember that game. I don't remember that, honestly.
Yeah, I remember Ramūnas Šiškauskas being, you know, just out of this world. And I mean, obviously, Lithuania always had, you know, super strong national teams. I didn't play that game, but we ended up losing, I think, if I'm not mistaken. We still advanced to the quarterfinal game against Spain, who ended up being in the finals against the Redeem team.
Yep.
But Lithuania had a stacked team. I mean, it was just...
But that Spain final, that was something I remember. Spain, U.S., that was a good final. Yeah, yeah, that was one of the was the first time that Rubio was good. That was the first time that U.S. had to fight through, and Dwayne Wade and Kobe were the ones that they did the business at the end.
Yeah. That was a tough game. That was also one of the best ones I've ever seen, honestly. I still, to this day, sometimes when I'm bored, I go on YouTube and I watch that game. And especially like the Kobe 3 when he shushed out and, you know, against Rudy Fernandez. That was an epic moment. But just the fact that Spain was so close, I mean, so close but so far away, you could say. You know,
because US,
you know, being close is a very, very abstract situation. You know, you're feeling like you're close, but you know, in one possession, they put you in your place, like they did with Serbia. Actually, I mean, it was literally one turnover, one fast break, and the game is over.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Split decision, split moment, split second, and it's you know, so close, but yet so far, and it's like it's really, really that's why basketball is so fun, because it can change at any moment. You are up. You're up by 24. Like Serbia was down 24 the game before that, and they come back. You know, like that's the beauty of the sport.
It's mind blowing. I keep talking to people the whole day today and commenting on the game. This is one of those games. Any kid watches it, and they're gonna pick up a basketball and start playing basketball. Yeah. They're gonna pick up the sport and go to the playground and try to be a Bogdanović or Jokic or a Steph Curry. There's so many guys today that, you know, can serve as great role models for kids to go into sport. And just the emotion, all the storylines that got into that yesterday's game, you know, Coach Pešić, him, you know, being at the helm, you know, LeBron and Curry playing together, chasing their first, you know, gold medal, then Durant basically taking over that Kobe slot as, you know, the designated killer that, you know, takes the last shot.
He had a huge shot.
That was incredible. Like LeBron James played a pick and pop with Kevin Durant, threw him the ball without even looking at the basket. He just threw him the ball and got out of the way. We're talking about the best player, you know, or one of the two best players, or three best players ever to play the game. He threw it to KD, and then Carmelo Anthony on the sidelines just waving everybody off and telling everybody, get the hell out of the way and let him do his thing. And then Kevin Durant just, you know, scoring that dagger. That reminded me a lot about that Kobe 3 in Beijing. It was the same feeling. I mean, this was obviously a semifinals, that was the finals game, but just, you know, overall a lot of interesting storylines. Joel Embiid playing in France, getting booed every time, and then being the key. Without Joel Embiid last night, they lose the game 100%. So I hope somebody writes a book or makes a hell of a documentary about this game yesterday. I think this one is going to go down as one of the greatest ones to ever be played.
Was it a travel, Embiid?
On Embiid, I don't know. When he scored on Jokic, or which one?
On that drive.
On the drive?
Yeah.
I mean, you're gonna call that travel in that situation?
I don't know. There's, you know, that's, I don't know. It's zero step. Maybe you take that extra gear. I can see it go either way.
I'm happy they didn't call it. You know, I was
just let it go
for Serbia, but. You want the game to be played. If you're gonna, plus you know better than anybody, like calling travel an international game is such a gray area. Like if you start calling those minutious little details and watch for, you know, especially like if you go with the same leg and same hand, that open step, it's gonna be travel, you know, every single time. And nobody wants to watch that basketball. That's why I had a lot of problems watching European basketball after I came back from the NBA. Honestly, I really struggled watching European basketball. Because it just opens up the game so much. The referees, you know, of course, the purest of the game in Europe, they're going to be like, oh, why does nobody call travel in the NBA? Well, who wants to watch refs call travel every third offense? You know, I don't want to pay to watch that game. I don't want to spend my time watching that type of basketball. I mean, so that's my personal opinion, obviously. So I prefer the game to be played, you know, if for some reason refs decide not to call a travel on a gray area call, I would call it like that. I'm fine with that, honestly.
Yeah, there's a fine line, and I think that the European game first of all, it's very much controlled by the coaches, but also the referees control the rhythm of the game in any US and Europe. You know, they have the control. So if it's a good staff, if it's a good group, they kind of get the rhythm and the feel for the game that they don't interrupt the rhythm. You know, it has to be some sort of flow unless they have, if they start off with calling every foul, they're going to have to call it the whole time. It's going to be a very rigid game to watch. I agree.
Who wants to watch that type of basketball? I mean, you know, fans are, it's getting harder and harder to keep the fans, you know, eyes on the screens and, you know, having them pay attention to the game with all the distractions that are happening on the phones and on the, you know, commercials and Instagrams and all of that. I mean, I catch myself following every game on two screens. It's just inevitable now. You know, I look at the stats, or, you know, if it's a timeout, I go on my social media, I look for comments, and not saying it's good or bad, it's just the new reality. So you have to keep the game, I think, entertaining and dynamic and not interrupted a lot with those travel calls and with foul calls. So but I commend the refs for doing a good job last night. I think they did a good job of controlling the rhythm of the game.
So you still sound very enthusiastic about the game after retirement, going into a different avenue. We're going to talk about the Sunset Sports Festival. That's something that you do right now. But in terms of enthusiasm, not losing interest in that, like, what's your aspiration when you watch the game now, being outside a player's career, you know, after finishing and starting a new identity, a new path? Yeah. What drives you? What's your inspiration to keep up with the stats, keep up with with what's happening in the sport?
Well, I'll tell you right now, very honestly, this is my third year in professional retirement. And for the first year and a half or 2 years, maybe even more, I really struggled watching basketball. So at one point, I actually stopped. I stopped watching basketball because I would see mistakes everywhere, and then things would just tick me off. And then I don't know if that was just, you know, the player in me, or if that's like a sort of a disorder that players have. But I couldn't watch a basketball game and enjoy it as a fan. And these Olympic Games is for the first time ever since I retired. And it started at the quarterfinals. I said, I'm going to watch every single of these games because, you know, watching four games in one day is, I mean, you watch games for a living, obviously. So, you know, for you, it's nothing. But I had a kind of a step away from the basketball just because I felt like I want to watch it with pleasure again. And those four matchups were incredible. And I watched all four of those games. And I said, wow, I really miss this. And this is high level basketball and high quality basketball. For a brief time, I was doing, I worked as a color commentator for Arena Sport, a regional TV here in Croatia, and I did NBA games on Sunday night, and I really enjoyed it quite a lot. But then when you do those games, you don't really watch them as a fan. You know, I get prepared for the game for 2 or 3 hours before. I read all the articles, all the Twitters, X's, you know, you do the numbers, and then you're kind of prepared for a game. You actually go to work. So I didn't look at those like, oh, I'm watching a game that I like, because you always have to be in the moment, observant. You have to say the right thing at the right time, keep people, you know, interested so they can enjoy the broadcast. So this is for the first time ever since I retired that I'm actually watching the games and enjoying them and, you know, and feeling the passion. I was really, really rooting for Serbia last night. I know a couple of guys on the team. But then again, when the USA won, I was also overwhelmed with, you know, their storylines, because you see Steph Curry, you know, greatest shooter to ever catch a basketball, jumping on LeBron James and then hugging with, you know, Kevin Durant. And you're like, wow, like these are the three best players of generation, just, you know, with so much passion. They want to win. It's hard, you know, to be, you know, to not like that. So I definitely now have a newfound passion for watching basketball games. And I think like this season, I'm going to get you know, I'm going to try to watch as many more as I can.
That's cool. That's something that's it. I can feel that. I can imagine that after you retire, you know, there's also a feeling of not contentness, not resentment, but more like a fullness, like just kind of exhaustion of basketball. You just have an overflow of information throughout your career, and always repetitive. It's the same thing, and you have. After you retire, and I feel that after I had injured, yeah, you see certain things when I was injured, and you start, and just it triggers you in a way where you're like, you just don't know how to, and that was not healthy. So I think it's good to get away from it. And now you have a newfound inspiration, especially with the high quality Olympics like this is, and you have now maybe a different input, you know, from different angles to kind of take you on to your next steps that you aspire to do.
Yeah. You see it through a different lens, definitely. So I think sometimes it's good to take that, you know, step aside and let things come to you. You know, I really didn't want to force it because I was really saturated. I think I was saturated with basketball and I was just drained emotionally, physically, you know, mentally. And when I reached my end, when I decided to retire, I was 100% done. My body could have went for another couple of years. I think physically now I still probably would be able to play at some level in a certain role. But just the mind was done. It was, you know, no more practices, no more repetitive moves. I felt like I did my whole trajectory and my life cycle, you know, from bottom to the top, all the way back to the bottom. And there was nothing left for me to kind of experience. You know, one thing I do regret is maybe not sticking around a little more to pass the knowledge on to you know, as a mentor to a younger guy in my position. But then again, I really felt like it wasn't meant to be. I wasn't, willing to put myself in a situation just to do it, you know, just so I have to do it. I felt like I needed to take care of myself emotionally and to kind of close that chapter. So now I really feel that, you know, desire and love for basketball coming back, which is, I think, is normal. You know, when you do something, I played basketball since I was 7 years old, you know, until I was 35. So that's almost 30 years of everyday basketball. So, you know, you do anything for 30 years on a high level and with 100% dedication, I mean, you're going to get exhausted either way.
Yeah, 100%. I started to play because my father was playing. I started playing when I was 6, 7, you know, putting the ball in. You were around the game, and there's periods of overwhelming emotions, overwhelming too much. And then there's where you got to get away. Also, when you're in a slump, I don't know how you were. When you're in a slump, sometimes it was good for me to get away from the game, to get away from the gym, to shoot less, to not think about it, and then to have just not feel the ball for a couple of days. I come back in, and then it's just kind of like it feels much lighter, much easier. Where, you know, in a slump and you go in the gym, it's the ball starts feeling heavy, the rim starts feeling smaller, everything is just off, and then you just kind of feel like, what the hell am I? Where is that? Where did I go? Like Space Jam, or where am I right now? So it felt good, like just as soon as practice was over, or even on an off day, I didn't go in just to get away. Then you come back in, and then you kind of you feel like your legs are back again. It's just it was much easier to get away than and then come back. So I think it's the same with the mind. Yeah. Is what I'm saying.
100%. I wish I would have known that, you know, when I played, I was always a player that depended a lot on the hours I put in and the work. So I always relied on my work and the extra work, extra shooting, you know, extra drills. And it was hard for me to take that break and say, okay, sometimes it's better not to do a practice than to go in the gym and have that practice, because that's what leads you to exhaustion and to not liking your day job and to being frustrated. Sometimes you really got to step aside. And I wish I had somebody to tell me, hey, dude, just don't go in the gym today. You know, it's fine if you don't shoot. You shot 1 million shots in your life. You know, you got them up. You have it in your muscle memory. Now you just got to kind of relax your mind. And actually, the first time I tried implementing that was toward the end of my career in Murcia. So I came back from the NBA, played a couple of years in Europe, and then I ended up on UCAM Murcia, which was, you know, in first division, ACB, a solid team. We were, you know, we had some good games that year. And that was the first year when I tried being the best shooter I can do without the extra work. And that was very weird for me. I was like, you know what? I'm older now. Maybe I should save my legs. And maybe, you know, I should start playing the mental game in terms of, okay, I'm going to get a break now. I'm not going to shoot those 200 shots after practice. And let's see how my shot feels tomorrow. And it actually kind of worked. And I shot 43 or 44% from the three. I ended up being, I think, second or third best percentage shooter in the ACB that year. But it just felt weird. You know, it felt weird. It's like, oh, am I cheating? You know, it felt like cheating, honestly, because you're used to doing something for 20 years in a certain way. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, but you see that you can actually reach the same result with a different methodology. And it just I learned it too late, honestly, and just felt weird.
It's the less is more mentality is hard to implement because you, like you said, you feel like you're cheating the game of not putting the hours in that you're supposed to put in. And I think it depends on the path that you're on early on. When you're still young, you have to put the hours in, and then you have the muscle memory, I think, at some point. Then you combine the muscle memory with the mental strength, with the confidence, all those things come into place. And I think if you have your legs ready, if you're prepared, fitness, if your fitness is right, Your mind is right. You don't have to put us, you just have to be efficient in practices.
100%. 100%. But it's also about the situation you're in. You know, the role you play, how many minutes you play, what is expected of you. I don't know. There's obviously a lot that goes into it. You know, not every team is the same. For me, I was toward the end of my career. I was a little frustrated with not getting a lot of playing time. And then it all kind of meshed together. But I was now looking in hindsight, when I left the NBA, I was not the same player anymore. You know, I finished my dream, and my dream was gone. And my dream was over. You know, mm-hmm. I had a dream of making it to the NBA. I played there for 3 years, did okay, you know, really felt validated, appreciated, and I felt like I did what I needed to do. And then when I came back to Europe, something was missing. I was still physically and in terms of experience, I was better than ever. But the mental part was different. You know, mm-hmm. you know what they say, hungry lions, they run faster, you know? And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I just felt like I wasn't hungry anymore to that extent that I would just, you know, go through a wall. You know, when you're climbing up mm-hmm. and you want to get to the top and you want to play in those, you know, Real Madrids and Barcelonas and the NBAs, there's nothing that stops you. You're not tired. You're, you know, you don't care what ball the game is being played with. You don't care if the floor is slippery. You don't care if the locker room is smelly. And then when I came back from the NBA, I started noticing like, you know, the little things just started getting on my nerves. And I felt like, oh, wow, am I spoiled? Am I, you know, what's happening with me?
You became a little bit negative, a little bit more negative than you were before?
I did. I really became negative. And for me, the adjustment from going from the NBA to Europe was very tough. It was very tough. I played all the levers of European basketball up to the point where I got to the NBA. And then coming back from the NBA, I had a hard time adjusting to the European basketball, especially EuroLeague, after coming back, which is crazy because it should have been easier, but it's definitely not. It was very hard for me. Yeah. And you know what's even crazier? The three-point line. I actually struggled getting adjusted back to the European three-point line because I had to change my shot in order to be efficient in the NBA. I had to make it faster because mm-hmm. the way I was shooting in Europe, it was, you know, technically perfect, but it was a bit slow for the NBA. So I made it to the NBA, and all of a sudden, for the first 4 or 5 months, everyone is blocking my shot. You know, I got Giannis Antetokounmpo running at me, and I'm thinking like, okay, I got this. And then you shoot it, and they touch it with the, you know, top of their fingertips. You're like, wow, I got to speed my stuff up. Otherwise, I'm going to get my shot blocked every time. So I had to change the, you know, momentum of my shot, the dynamics and the form of my shot. And then when I came back to Europe, I felt like it wasn't the same anymore. And it was very, very weird for me. So I did turn a little negative. But now looking in hindsight and analyzing everything and looking it through, you know, obviously a fresh set of eyes, I did come with a little bit of a negative, you know, attitude. And I was frustrated. And then, you know, it really didn't play out all that well for me after returning from the NBA. And that's something I really, you know, wish would have went a little differently. But, you know, in the end, everything leads you to where you need to be, you know. Now, those 3-4 years after the NBA led me to my retirement, and now I'm, you know, really, really content with how everything played out.
So I wanted to dig on that, because where do you think the negativity rooted from? Because was there like some sort of expectation effect that did not meet your expectation? Was there something, a bitter taste from the NBA that you brought with you? Was there negativity?
I know exactly what it was. I transformed myself into a specialized shooter. I was a catch and shoot player and nothing more, nothing less. So I did that transformation and that specialization when I was in Europe in order to make it to the highest level. I didn't care whether it was the Real Madrid or the NBA, but I wanted to become the best catch and shoot player that I can be. And in my mind, I said to myself, I'm going to become the best catch and shoot player in Europe. And that was my goal. Where that's going to lead me, I have no idea. But in order for me to do that, I had to basically forget all the other aspects of my game. So I literally, you know, forgot how to dribble, forgot how to pass. I had no interest in dribbling more than one or two times. So I was basically just, you know, a role player. And it ended up working perfectly for the NBA because I found my place and I had my role. But then coming back to Europe, they expect you to do a little more, mm-hmm. you know, especially coming from the NBA. They expect you to post up. They expect you to grab a rebound. They expect you to do this, do that. And I didn't have that in me anymore. Or you know, I let it go. I kind of let it go. And I didn't feel like relearning all of that and changing my style of play again. I kind of lost that power of adaptation. I just wanted to catch the ball and shoot the ball. And I was really one-dimensional toward the end of my career. And that was when frustration came in, because I felt like I didn't blend well with the style of play in Europe anymore. To, you know, where I played in Europe before going to the NBA, I was much more versatile. I did many different things when I played for Zaragoza. But then after I specialized for three-point shooting, I felt like, you know, that kind of hurt me in the long run. It led me to where I wanted to go. But then, you know, coming back to Europe, I felt like it wasn't the same anymore.
Interesting. I never thought of that, because I guess it's also dependent on the player's style that is playing in the NBA versus Europe. You know, if like a specialization, I can see that you became elite, you know, in one thing, and then it depends also what the team. Yeah, in hindsight, the team would know what they're getting, right? Like they would have to kind of anticipate that what they're gonna get is this is what they have. And being in an NBA for 3 years is not the same thing as being in NBA for 3 months and then coming back, you know. So it's kind of like you already had an adapted role, and you had your niche, and you had your particular way of playing. So there's also an expectation effect from the team side, I think, that when they're getting a player, that they have to know in terms of how to use it, which kind of system is going to come into, and how to kind of make him flourish in that system in a new environment.
Absolutely. I don't think some teams in Europe, well, it depends on the level. Obviously, you know, the top EuroLeague teams, they know what they're doing. But a lot of teams, they don't understand that mental game for a player to come from the NBA and play in Europe. When you come from the NBA, I had that feeling, and I was like, what is wrong with me? I was playing for Valencia, I think. And, you know, we play Real Madrid, and it's the highest level possible game in Europe that you can imagine. I mean, it's, you know, it was a EuroLeague game, and it wasn't even an ACB game. So very, very important, high level, super, you know, pressure game. And I felt like, oh, you know, this is weak compared to the NBA, which is crazy, which is really crazy. But you come from the NBA, the lights shine brighter. You know, there's celebrities in the front row. The floor is, you know, polished perfectly. Everything is incredibly organized. You fly private. And then, you know, you go to a level down and you're like, oh, you know, this is not the same anymore. The feeling is not the same. The sensation is not the same. The environment is not the same. So it kind of starts playing with your mind, and you're like, oh, do I really want to be doing this? You know, if I'm never going to reach that level again, does it make sense to play anything below it? You know, not to say that necessarily has to be your state of mind the whole time, but those are the issues and thoughts that players for sure are getting when they come back from the NBA. Not saying if it's good or bad, but it's just normal. You know, you see it once and you're like, oh, you know, how do I function now?
I have a good metaphor. You go fly business class or first class one time, and then you have to go back to economy. There is a difference. I mean, no, you can adjust. You can adjust. You can deal with it. You know, but then it's like, oh, it's very nice in business class. It's very nice. I mean, you there's a different taste of it, different food, different service. Yeah. You know, you can compare that to the media attention, to the, like you said, celebrities. It's a completely different aura. And then you go back to economy. It's like, all right, that's cool. I mean, we're still traveling. You know, I understand.
That's a great comparison. So, like I said, I think those things are normal. It's just a question of, you know, having that person in the team saying, hey, you know, we got to figure out how to, you know, get this guy right mentally, and to present, you know, objects or challenges here that you can kind of strive for, or, you know, it's a different motivation. It's just different. So and obviously it's very individual. You know, not saying that what happened to me would happen to any other player. There are players that don't care where they play. They're going to go 100%. They're going to be hungry until, you know, until their feet fall off or until the wheels fall off. I wasn't that guy. I definitely wasn't that guy. I put all my life, all my energy, all my effort into making it at the highest level. And then once I started dropping back down, it really affected me mentally. And that it showed, it really showed in my performance.
So when you retired, what learned behaviors or patterns or programming that you had as a player that you have to unlearn when you retired, when you went into past the player's life? What are some learned behaviors that you had to unwire?
Oh man, so many. It's crazy. I mean, the shock of civil life over regular day-to-day life is just something that you're not ready for. That there's nothing that can prepare you for that. You're just, the bubble you live in as a professional athlete is just on a whole nother level. I don't think there's an executive or you know, I think maybe military service could be close to comparing it to professional sports, just the day-to-day activity. Like, what's the reason you have to get out of the house? There's no more practice. You know, who are you going to spend your time with? There, the locker room is full of 12 guys that you share everything with on a daily basis. And now all of a sudden, you know, where are those guys? You know, you don't walk into a locker room. You don't have a common goal. Depends if you have a family or not. Like, how do you spend your day? Literally, how do you wake up in the morning and what's going to happen for the rest of the day? And then what's going to happen for the rest of the week? And what's the goal, your life goal for this season or for this calendar year? So just the timeline shifted drastically, because you operate on a certain timeline as a professional athlete. You know, there's summertime, there's national team, then the small break, and then it's training camp. And then that happened for 20 years repetitively. And then, you know, all of a sudden season starts and you're watching it on TV and you're like, oh, okay. I mean, this is nice. I get to go skiing for the first time, or this is nice. I get to spend time with my family. But then it really goes down to the question of how you want to spend your day, literally. Like, how do you, what's going to be your day to day? So that was the biggest challenge for me, for sure.
So you said no questions off limits. So I'm going to test the line right here. All right. I'm going to test the bar. So there's a lot of also coaches that I've talked to that had also trouble with that when they didn't have a job and they're at home all of a sudden more. Also retired players, they're at home a lot more. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if you already had family, I think, when you retired, right? So there was
yeah, when I, yeah.
So was there any kind of different rhythm dynamic that you had with at home with your family that created that you're at home more than normally and you're frustrated with certain situations and that could cause trouble at home? So it kind of fighting and kind of disagreements and the completely different conversations that you're having that you had before, because the rhythm also changes for the wife and the family, because all of a sudden now you're there around. So how was that dynamic?
You're there, baby's crying, the wife is nervous, you got to get out the house. And there's no practice. There's no game. So, like, where do you go? It definitely changes. It's challenging. It's normal. I think that's something that for players who have families, when they stop playing, it's a challenge they're going to face. And it's a challenge that I face, obviously. You want to spend time with your family. You want to be there. But you also have to have that, you know, peace of mind and have your own dynamics. So, obviously, I started by just basically working out every day. I wake up in the morning and I go to work out. You got to, because you're used to it. You wake up, you leave the house. So I try to keep that as much as I could for the first year. And then I realized, wow, practice is making me tired. Like, I've been practicing my whole life. Like, do I really want to keep practicing? Like, why don't I get some rest? Like, my body needs rest. And, you know, you try to swim, you do Pilates, you do yoga, you do this, you do that. You hit your body with different impulses just to kind of switch it up a little bit. But in the end, I enrolled into a university. I wanted to learn. I got this desire to learn something that I didn't know nothing about. So I said to myself, okay, I'm a 35-year-old man. I did well in my first career and what I did so far in my life. But now there's 30 or 40 years in front of me. What am I going to do? Like, what am I going to dedicate my time to? I have this knowledge. I have this network. I have, you know, a name that I made for myself. So how do I kind of, you know, round all of that up and turn it into something that makes sense for me to kind of have a day-to-day activity. So I decided to basically enroll into business school. MBA has a fantastic program. MBPA, actually, MBA Players Association, has a collaboration with the University of Bocconi in Milan, which Matteo Zuretti from the MBPA is running with Professor Dino Ruta. And it allowed me to enroll. And I actually have a scholarship from the MBA based on the benefits that I secured while I was in the MBA. And then I said, okay, I'm going to invest this in myself and try to figure out, you know, if I can learn something that's going to enable me to do something for the next 30 years. And I'm in the middle of that process right now. I'm kind of finishing up my fourth module as we speak. So I think I have a year left in front of me of being a college student. But it helped because it gives you, you know, you get to learn something, you hit your brain with different stuff, you read books, you hang out with different people, you open up some different opportunities for yourself. So it's just a different environment. But yeah, to go back to your original question, you definitely have to figure out a way to get out the house and to make it make sense.
Yeah, you find a new purpose, because athletes die two deaths, and you have to find a new purpose in terms of like new routine, I don't know the bubbles. I don't know what the balloons mean here. They come up sometimes. It just happens randomly. Balloons that thumb up, whatever. For people who didn't see it, I mean, it's just.
No, it was great. And then balloons come up.
We're celebrating, baby. So it's just two deaths, and you have to find a new purpose. You have to find a new ikigai. You have to find a new way of living and new rhythm. New, like you said, you're working out. Your body's used to exerting energy. You have to give the body what it's asking for, because that's something that it's used to. Other people who never worked out, they're not used to it. So it's not like this, it's a necessity. Yeah. But our bodies are, I need to work out. I feel it. If I don't work out, I get anxious. I get a little bit triggered. I get easier nervous. And I feel like if I work out, I feel calm. It calms my body down. I'm a little bit easier going. And it's a much better flow.
100%. And it's a question of being healthy, right? I mean, I feel 100%. My body being super unhealthy the last couple of months because I've been working so much. I didn't have time to work out as much as I should have, considering what my body is used to. So, I mean, it draws different consequences. But it goes back to the question of finding a new identity, I would say. Like you said, you die once and then you're like, okay, who am I? You really start. I had a funny phase in which I was literally sitting on my couch when I was alone at the house. I'm like, what? Who am I? Like, literally, do I really want to be that guy? Who, you know, you walk the street and it's like, you know, is that him? Like, no, it's not him. He used to play. Like, didn't he play? Maybe he played, you know, somebody knows your name. And then actually there's an anecdote that really put things in perspective for me. When I played in the NBA, Bojan Bogdanović and myself, we were the only two Croatians in the NBA. So there was really a lot of people in Zagreb and in Croatia that knew me, knew my name, they follow basketball. So people would approach you. And you can tell when you walk the street, people recognize you. They're like, oh, that's him. That's Damian. And then 3 or 4 years after I left the NBA, when I played in Murcia, for example, or somewhere, they're like, is that him? Maybe that's him. That's not him. People they start forgetting or they're not sure. And then one night when I stopped, I was toward the end of my career and I was walking my street toward home. Literally, I was walking in my neighborhood and a guy walked by me and he was walking his dog. So, you know, it was like a rainy evening and I'm walking toward my house and he kind of looks at me and I could tell he was exploring my face and he was like, hey, didn't you used to play basketball? I was like, yeah. He was like, wow, for a brief moment, you're really, really good. I was like, holy shit, like this guy just put my whole life in perspective. Like I'm a person that for a brief moment in time, I was really good at my job. Nothing more, nothing less. Like from his perspective, that's me, that's my life, you know? So that really kind of, because when you're a player, you're all about yourself and you're the sun making everything turn. So everyone revolves around you. And in this guy's eyes, I was like, all right, I was a guy that, you know, that played basketball well for a couple of years. That's it, literally. So I wanted to hug him after that. I was like, I think this guy might have really, you know, pushed me toward my second life, because you're not that important. You know, even the greatest athlete of all times, you know, after
that's,
a while.
That's cool. Yeah. He put a lid on it.
He really gave me a closure. And I think he gave me the closure and the applause that I needed. He was like, he gave me a validation. He was like, it was worth your time. Like, I'm a guy walking the street. I recognize you and I'm giving you credit for what you did. You were great at it. You know, you weren't great at it for 30 years and, you know, but you were really good at what you did. And, you know, it was worth your time. It was worth your effort. So I think it played a really big emotional part in my decision to stop playing. And it allowed me to look at myself through different eyes, because it's like, all right, who am I really? Like, because at one point where you're a successful athlete, you're walking in the streets like you're the shit. Right. Yeah. I mean, you're the most important guy in the world. You're an NBA player. How many NBA players are there in the world? 450, maybe 500. How many players play basketball? Tens and hundreds of millions. So everybody wants to be in the NBA. So you're thinking like, I'm that special guy. And then after, you know, a while and as time goes by and, you know, you're no longer in the NBA, you're really not that special guy. You're really not. You're a guy like everybody else. Did you have success? Yeah, absolutely. But now some other kids are wearing the jerseys and now some other people are on TV and you got to find a different thing for yourself that you got to kind of fill your life with. So it was a very interesting period, I would say.
It's a humbling experience afterwards. I think that you have to be humble enough to admit it. And then that's when you admit it. That's when you move on. That's when you kind of like, that's the first step to healing. It's a healing process as well. So
100%. It's really, truly a healing process. And I think you need that closure where you cry your heart out. You say like, okay, I gave it everything I had. It was good or bad. you know, I did this, I did that. You kind of wrap things up and then you kind of start moving toward the next phase of your life. But it's really a healing process. Yeah, it's a mourning phase. It's like mourning the death of your, you know, yourself, of your cousin, of your relative. It's a person died. A person definitely died. The day you decide to retire, a person dies.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a good segment, good segue to our new segment, ProBallers.com. And I'm gonna share my screen with you and we're gonna check something out. We're gonna check something out.
All right.
I'm gonna show you.
I have no idea what to expect now. I'm actually excited.
All right. You see the screen here?
Yep.
All right. So I'm gonna type in your name. And you're gonna come up here. So I'm going to go to games right now. So everybody who's not watching can go to ProBallers.com, type in a name. I'm signed in with my name. You can favorite a player, follow him. And then I'm going to go to your first NBA season, which was 15-16?
I think 14-15 was my first year.
14-15. Yeah, 14-15. Yep. So now I was looking at that, and now we're looking at your first game, Philadelphia 76ers.
Yeah.
You had 15 minutes and zeros across the board. Minus two efficiency, a very poor day. The team wins. That's a good sign. And then you recover and you play against Memphis 2 days later and you have 11 points, 3-for-4, yeah. 3-pointers, 11 points, 20 minutes. So what shifted? What do you remember from that first game that you stepped on the floor on an official game? And leading up to it, and then the change from the first to the second game. What do you remember from that?
Yeah, well, you know, I was lucky enough to play, I think, 7 preseason games. So it kind of gives you a sense of what regular season is going to be like. It wasn't that much different, I would say, just in terms of the speed and the, you know, going up and down the court and the physicality. But I'm not going to lie, I was nervous. That first official game, we played at home, and I shot 2 very bad shots just because I had a feeling like I got to get them out of my system. It's like okay, I'm a shooter, I'm on a court, I got to get my shot up. And they ended up not falling. I really struggled heavily with my legs for the first 3 or 4 months until New Year's, I would say. I really had trouble adjusting to the speed and to the, you know, the 3-point range. I felt like all my shots were short. Everything ended up hitting the first rim. And I really didn't feel all that well. And then I had a conversation with Coach Vogel, who had a lot of trust with me. I could tell even in preseason and, you know, the way he was talking to me, he was very calm. He was like, once you get your legs under you, you're going to be a 60% shooter in this league. And I said, like, wow, I feel like that's really something that could happen. But obviously, that's a process that I got to go through in order to get to that point. He was just, don't stop shooting the ball. And then, funny enough, my first NBA points came against one of my idols, Vince Carter, who played for Memphis Grizzlies. And I just had a mindset of, all right, I'm going to go in, take my shots, and whatever happens, happens. These guys signed me to a 3-year contract. So if they want to fire me after, you know, a bad first week, I guess, you know, it's not meant for me to be. Mm-hmm. But I felt like they had trust in me and they knew I was going to perform well and shoot well just because I put in a lot of work. I got my shots up early, before practice, after practice. And in moments when I did feel good, I felt like, all right, I have a place in this league. So it was just a question of when it's going to, you know, when I'm going to showcase it or erupt to a certain degree with my 3-point percentage shooting. And then, you know, first play on the court, I'm playing like a handoff with LaVoy Allen, and then Vince Carter is in front of me. And I'm like, you know, screw it. I'm just going to pull the trigger. Then, you know, as a shooter, once that first one goes in, it's done. It's like it's immediate heat check. You want the next one. And then I remember shooting, I think I hit 3 consecutive threes in, I think, first quarter, in the first couple of minutes of me being on the court. And I remember Courtney Lee, you know, yelling like, no more for him, no more for him. Like, you know, no more for him. I'm going to start guarding you. Like, I'm going to lock you down. He was threatening to start, you know, guarding me himself. And I was like, I could care less about who's guarding me right now. You know, I feel hot. I'm the new kid on the block. I can shoot it. And, you know, let's see what happens. So you kind of get that first wave of arrogance coming to you. You're like, all right, I have an NBA jersey on. I'm on this floor. People are rooting for me. There's no reason for me to feel inferior. So once the shots start falling, you're like, all right, this is going to be okay. So that was the first, you know, first couple of games. And then it was ups and I had a lot of ups and downs until I would say February. I think it wasn't until February where I got my rhythm.
Yeah, I can see how it started. Yeah.
But I was really happy that I played most of the games that year. I think 60 something games. I missed some of them due to illness. I even started two games, and I really felt trust from all of my team. I could tell how happy they were when I was scoring the threes, and I could tell that Coach Vogel really had a lot of trust in me. Even when we played big games against, you know, high level players, we play against LeBron James. He's telling me, like, I'm not worried at all about. I remember this vividly. We're walking through the tunnel, and he's telling me, I'm not worried about you guarding LeBron James. I'm worried about you guarding Terrence Ross and, like, the little hopsy, fast guys. And, you know, a coach saying that to you, I'm not worried about you guarding LeBron James, even if he meant it or if he pretended that he didn't worry, it meant a lot to me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, nobody in the world can stop LeBron James, but it's just the fact of me being in front of him and having the faith of the team to kind of, it's a joint venture, obviously, stopping him. There's not one guy that can stop him. But hearing those words, it's like, holy shit, like, this guy really has faith in me. So it meant a lot for my confidence.
That's one thing I think is very important for coaches also to hear. I remember a small story. I mean, I was played on a much lower level. I played in Division II in college, and I was a freshman, and the coach stopped practice, and I was a freshman starting, and the veteran group around me, which won a conference title before I got there, the coach stopped, and it's like, look, if he's open, he has the neon green light. Give him the ball. He's going to shoot it every time. Nobody has to worry about anything. If he's open, he better get the ball. My confidence level just shot up twofold. You know, it was like the percentages went up. Everything I was shooting, bad shot, good shot, deep shot, and it was like it was cool. Like, it was something that I had. I was wondering if you would know your record of how many the most threes you attempted, because mine was 17. I had 17 three attempts in one game.
A Lithuanian that can shoot the ball. What a shock.
What a shocker.
What a shocker. I've never seen that before.
What's the most threes you attempted?
I wasn't going too crazy with it, to be honest. I don't think I ever attempted more than 10-ish, 11-ish, 12. I had a great game in Cedevita. We played against Gran Canaria in the Euro Cup, and I scored 35 points. I scored 8 threes. So I think I might have missed a couple, maybe one or two or three. So, but I never shot, like, you know, 15 or 16, or there were guys that were getting him up. Like, and looking in hindsight, there were games where I could have eased my arm a little more and got a few more up. I think I could have easily went up to like 14 or 15, but I don't think I ever shot more than 12 threes in a game, to be honest.
It says 10 right here.
It's 10. There we go. See?
In 2010 against Cedevita against Zagreb.
Okay. Yeah. See? Which is strange, because I was a 3-point shooter, but
yeah.
Yeah, in the ACB, you don't really get a lot of shots as a player. I mean, it's evenly distributed. You know how it is in the ACB. Nobody really gets to shoot like 40 times a game. But yeah, so I was just trying to make the most out of my shots. I was trying to be as efficient as I could, to be honest. That's actually what led me to finding my niche and being specialized, because I was being frustrated because in Zaragoza, when I played, we had 8 import players. So all of 8 of us were, you know, we had similar contracts, similar statuses. We all thought we were the guy on the team. And it's like, it was very evenly distributed, the playing time, the roles, and the shots. So sometimes I'm playing the ACB and we're playing the Real Madrids and Barcelonas, and sometimes I get 2 shots a game. You know, you only get 2 shots.
That's how it is. It's equal opportunity.
Equal opportunity. It's like, dude, I worked the whole week. And now you have to, you know how it is in the ACB. If you don't play European competition, you got to wait for a week for the next game, which was excruciating. It's like, holy shit, I have to wait for 7 days for another chance. And then next game, you get into early foul trouble. And it's like another week goes by. And you're like, oh my God, I'm the worst player in the world. Then all of a sudden, 3 weeks in a row, you score 10, 12, 20 points. You're like, oh, okay, I'm finally getting my groove. It's hard to catch your rhythm when you play only one game a week. That was the case in my first year in Zaragoza. But long story short, it led me to really finding a way to be efficient. I was like, okay, if I'm only going to get 3 to 5, 3 to 6 shots a game, I'm going to make them all 3-pointers, and I'm going to, you know, try to make the most of them and score as many points as I can in that short amount of time, or, you know, whatever the case may be that game. That's what actually led me to being specialized.
You become more efficient in that less time. You find a way to really maximize the touches that you get. You know, quick decisions, decision making is really to the cue, whether shoot, dribble, pass, whatever. And you're very much more in tune with the passes and the possessions that you get.
Absolutely. To whereas where you have all the freedom in the world to kind of create, to do, you know, I can choose where I can post up, I can do this, I can play. You know, early in my career, I really struggled with finding my identity because I had the ability to do multiple things on the court. And you're like, okay, what do I really do? Do I post up? Do I play pick and roll? I'm kind of too tall and too slow to play, to run the pick and roll. But then again, I can shoot it. I have a good vision. So I was kind of evened out. I did everything well, but nothing super extra out of the ordinary, best in the world. So it kind of led to really finding my role. I was like, okay, what do I do as a player? Am I a cutter? Am I a one-on-one player? Am I a catch-and-shoot player? So I had different phases early in my career in which I really struggled with my identity. Mm-hmm. And it really showed in my performance. I was a talented kid that could put the ball in the basket. But, okay, what do we do with you in a professional basketball team? Mm-hmm. You know, what do we do with you? What's your position? Where do you play? When do we put you in the game? How can you contribute to us winning a championship? That's the key. For you know, players moving from youth categories to first teams, it's like, okay, like this is, everybody has a role here. So what is your role? So
and what put you in that role? Like what was the key moment when you discovered it?
I was 25 years old and I played for Cibona in Croatia, in Zagreb. And I played for Jasmin Repeša, one of the greatest Croatian coaches of all time. And he was the one who actually found me my position. He was like, just whenever you catch it, shoot it. That's it. You're going to be great at it. You're going to be efficient at it. No reason to worry yourself with inventing basketballs for yourself or inventing shots mm-hmm. for yourself. Like, don't kill yourself with being the creator. You're not the creator. You're the executioner. Like, the ball comes to you and then you execute. So that really, I was like, okay, it makes sense. Just, you know, as long as I have guys feeding me the ball or getting me open, that was when I was the most efficient. And then everything else was just a waste of energy. And, you mm-hmm. know, it comes to you. Some guys figure it out early. Some guys figure it out later. Some guys never figure it out. You have a lot of guys that you see, you're like, ah, he hasn't found his spot.
He doesn't know who he is as a player. Well, he doesn't know who he is. Mm-hmm.
And then players get frustrated because are you an amazing basketball player? Yes. I mean, literally everyone in the NBA wearing an NBA jersey is an amazing basketball player. You give anybody there 30 minutes and 20 shots, you know, people are going to score the ball or do something well. And then it's like, all right, how do you find your spot? How do you find your role? That's a question of, and European basketball is, you know, it's ruthless, man. It's ruthless. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't really get too many second chances. If you're playing at a certain level, you're either going to stay there or, you know, you're going to drop or how do you advance through the levels? And I started playing in Croatia. So I didn't sign for Real Madrid or Barcelona immediately. You know, I had to find my way through ups and downs. So it's very interesting. Now looking at it, it's fun to think about it. But you see it now with a lot of guys. They're like, oh, he hasn't found his role yet. He mm-hmm. hasn't found his role. Aaron Gordon. I play with Aaron Gordon. Same thing. I play with Aaron Gordon in mm-hmm. Orlando. He was trying to do everything. When I say everything, he was trying to run offense, you know, dribble the ball up the floor, post up, play pick and roll, shoot threes. It's like, dude, like, what are you doing? You know, and you can tell, but it's a question of putting him in a certain role so he can be the best at it. And now with Jokic and with Coach Malone, he's the most perfect fit for Denver Nuggets ever. And he led them, you know, he helped lead them to the championship and he's a perfect complementary piece. Playing at that dunker spot, you know, finding that pocket. But then again, you get Jokic out of Denver, you know, what's Aaron Gordon's role there? Is he going to have another player doing that short role and throwing the lobs at him? You know, you take that away, his role changes, his identity changes. So just one example. I mean, obviously he's a phenomenal, you know, guy, phenomenal player, but a great example of how to, you know, a fit is so important for a player's career.
Totally. Fit, timing, you know, who you're playing with, who's above you in terms of hierarchy, who you're adjusting, because there's also alpha dogs going at each other. And then it's like, okay, now you kind of adjust to each other and you find your role, your niche, according to who you're playing with, who you're playing for, exactly. Which system. And, you know, that kind of like, then you kind of molds into a new identity, a new team. And then you find your groove on a same player finds his groove on a different team because the teammates and the hierarchy is different. I mean, it's a lot of times it takes also mind the right mindset to adjust to it.
Also, the business side, like you said, the hierarchy, it's a perfect leeway to who's making more money than you on the team. You know, who's, if the guy's getting paid $15 million per year, you're not going to play before him, you know, and you're making $1 million. If he's making 15 times more than you're making, it's very unlikely you're going to have playing time above him. I have a great example also from Orlando. Orlando Magic, it was my last year in the NBA. Coach Vogel wanted me back. He went from Indiana to Orlando, so he took me with him. And in Orlando, I had a lot of players in my position. So I was, that's when the game changed in the NBA. So threes became fours, four became fives. That was when Golden State won the, you know, the championship with their dead lineup of death. And that's when the game got smaller. You know, everybody wanted to shoot. So I was kind of playing between three and four, even though some games Vogel would put me at the five. And I actually remember guarding Alexis Ajinka. And I'm like guarding Alexis Ajinka. I'm like, how is this even happening? But he's like, no worry, just box him out because he's not going to be their first option on offense. So no reason for you to worry about the post up. So it
makes
ended
sense.
It ended up completely changing the dynamics of the game. But what I wanted to say was I had Jeff Green, Mario Hezonja, Eric Gordon, Serge Ibaka, Nikola Vucevic. I had five guys in front of me on 3-4 spot, you know, and then I was like, okay, how am I ever going to get some playing time? All of them are, you know, better than me. All of them are making much more money than I'm making. A lot of them are Orlando's draft picks, so they kind of have to invest in their draft picks. It's like, how do I get on the court? And the funny thing was, whenever I would be on the court, my plus minus was through the roof. It was just through the roof. And Vogel really appreciated it. And I was frustrated because it's like, oh, don't you see I'm, you know, really working well with the team and that I'm good for the group. But that was my kind of, you know, that's a player and you're thinking like, oh, I should play more. Well, in fact, of course, I can't play before any of those guys. I'm not as good. You know, now looking in hindsight, it's like I wouldn't play me, you know, before any of them, obviously. You know, they're world-class players. And I was a world-class player too in my own niche and what I was doing. But just the business side of it is like, dude, like we're paying Jeff Green $15 million. We're paying you $1 million. Like there's not a person in this arena that's going to play you before him. You know, and it's just about question of putting things in perspective. But as a player, you always have that ego. You're like, oh, I want to play. I want to contribute. I'm better than this guy. Why doesn't coach play me? So there's a lot of things that go into it, right? Is the business side in the NBA is just crucial. And some guys don't get it. They're just, you know, stay frustrated. And they're like, no, you got to play the game at so many levels in the NBA, so many levels. It can't just the courts.
So you said business. Let's talk about the Sunset Sports Festival, because those are things I'm sure that you guys talk also about, you know, contracts and any kind of like, I'm curious about the people that you had on the festival itself, the topics you guys go through. It's a three-day festival.
Yeah, it's a three-day event. So it's basically a sport business conference, but we're calling it a festival because it happens in Croatia. It's very relaxed. It's happening in the Mediterranean. And, you know, a lot of these conferences, and I'm sure you've been to a lot of them, whether it's a media conference or a business conference, they're just dry. They're boring. You know, people kill you with PowerPoints and with business cards, and everyone is kind of wearing a suit, and it's always happening in a hotel, like a conference room. And we wanted to make something funky. We wanted to make something very enjoyable, something where people are going to come and network, and you're going to hear phenomenal panels. You're going to have, you know, top level speakers, the keynotes. The content is going to be on point, just in terms of following the latest trends from the sport business industry, whether it's, you know, the media rights, whether it's Miško Ražnatović talking about how he discovered Nikola Jokic and Boban Marjanović. You know, we had Steven Jackson and Matt Barnes come through to Croatia with their All the Smoke podcast. They were talking about how they found their way in and how they found their spot in the podcast world, because obviously there's so many podcasts now. You have a podcast. How do you get people's attention? Like you have to have good content, good guests. And then, you know, where do you put it? What's the platform? How do you advertise it? How do you monetize it? So just the business side of sports is huge. And the more I'm getting into it, now getting into the fourth year of the Sunset Sports Festival, the more I discover, you know, the sports startups, the Sofa Scores, the Flash Scores, the, you know, you name it, all the apps, the NBAs, the FIFAs, the FIFPros. There's so many initiatives in sports. There's so many startups. There's so many companies. The data. I mean, think about what data is doing to today's sports. So we have a couple of panels that are dedicated just to data processing. What you can do with it. You know, how do you monetize? What can be done with it? How it's changing the landscape of all the sports, not just basketball or tennis. So it's very, very interesting, and it gives me a different perspective on sports completely, because, you know, I was a player and I saw it through one set of eyes, and now I look at it more through an executive set of eyes, through the business side. So long story short, Sunset Sports Festival is, you know, going into its fourth year, and I'm very happy that I got involved with the project. My partners are Croatian. They're, you know, veteran in events industry in Croatia, and also Pete Radovic, who is an American CBS executive with Croatian roots. He won 45 Emmys. He's a person also involved in the project. So through him, we were lucky enough to bring, you know, Steven Jackson and Matt Barnes and Steven Espinoza, Alessandro Del Piero, Bill Belichick. We had Bill Belichick come through this year, which was incredible because, you know, he was sharing stories about Tom Brady.
Boston's and own. Yeah. How did he get a Croatian passport?
Yeah, we got him a Croatian passport, man. It happened on our festival. That was incredible. That was such a interesting process. I mean, I had to, with the help of my friends and partners, to organize everything through Croatian consulate and, you know, with the Croatian prime minister, with the Croatian president. Everyone wanted to touch Bill Belichick when he came to Croatia. So there was a lot of people involved in making it happen. And it was very interesting, man. Once we pulled out the passport, the Croatian passport, on the stage in front of 500 people, it was a special moment. I mean, a standing ovation, and the fact that Bill Belichick got his passport, Croatian passport, at our festival just makes it so special. So I'm happy that we managed to do, you know, phenomenal things in those 3 years. Basically, the goal is to have everyone involved in sport business come to Croatia for 2.5-3 days, enjoy the sun and the sea, and just basically network, hear the latest from the sports industry. You know, we had people from FIBA come through, Frank Landers, who the head of media marketing for FIBA. We had a lot of people from basketball world, Mateo Zuretti, Boštjan Nahbar, who is the director of EuroLeague Players Association. So also a guy I used to play against. So now we kind of had a panel together along with Mateo Zuretti. So it was very interesting. And, you know,
both of them were on the podcast too. Boki and Mateo were on the podcast too.
Oh, they came on your podcast.
Yeah,
great guys. You know, experts in their own fields and you know, phenomenal human beings. They helped me out a lot in my transition. And you know, those are the people that I'm really looking up to for my second career. And then so we're looking to grow the conference into, you know, a marquee event where everyone in the sport business is going to come and kind of hang out for 3 days and add value and hopefully learn some stuff along the way.
Did you have trouble deciding after your career, whenever this opportunity came up, whether you want to go into coaching or you want to go into business? Was there some like a crossroad where you kind of thinking about going one way or the other?
That was the first crossroad because when I stopped playing in Croatia, I spent, I would say, 9-10 months just sitting at home and, you know, enjoying the life. Let's call it like that. You're retired for the first time. So it's like, okay, I'm going to go skiing. I'm going to go swimming. I'm going to go party. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then when it came to a point where it's like, okay, what am I going to do with my life? Naturally, the question of coaching came to mind because I always wanted to be a coach. Honestly, even toward the end of my career, I felt like I have, you know, what is needed to in order to be a coach, just in terms of the outlook on the game and the communication skills. And I could tell by the way guys are responding to my advice and to my knowledge. And I felt like there was something there to explore, possibly. But then the business side just became too interested. And my logic was, I'm going to try the business side for the first time because it gives me a unique opportunity to step outside the game of basketball for the first time. And who knows if I go into coaching now, if I'm ever going to have that experience to try something else. I've been in the gym for my whole life, and then I kind of felt the need to get out the gym. So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to try to do the business side for a couple of years, try to learn as much as I can, gather the experience, and basically experience the real world, the business world, and, you know, the regular life. And then, you know, if it comes to me and if things go that way, hopefully I'm going to go into coaching, or, you know, we'll see how things shake out. You never know what the future brings. So I do have my coaching license. I obtained it in Croatia. So I do have an option to hopefully coach one day. And it, you know, the thought is always in my mind. But the business side right now is very exciting, and it's going well, and it's teaching me a lot, and I'm learning a lot of things along the way. So we'll see what happens in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's like your second life now as a professional just started. So you still have time. You know, there's also no time to rush, and you have plenty. It's good. I like to call it like a tea specialist. You know, like that, whatever you niche you choose, you know, it's a stem that you choose. I mean, basketball is the stem that we have. But the more information you can gather and on this wide spectrum of information that's out there, whether it's from podcasts, from mindset, psychology, science, whatever you choose, you know, you can always apply it to just the stem of your sport or of your avenue that you chose. So I feel like the more time you take, you gather information, and at some point you put everything into that one stem, and then you become a better specialist because of the information you gather along the way from the other parts of the world.
You said it best. I mean, you literally explained it right now. So I'm thinking in my mind, whatever I learn now, when I'm out there, you know, in the business world, I'm hopefully going to be able to apply it, whether in coaching or in an executive role, being involved with basketball, or, you know, whatever the road may take me, you know, learning a lot about the events industry, about marketing, about the media side, and just overall about the business side of sports, because it's not something that you have a chance to experience when you're a player. I'll tell you a funny story. I mean, I played so many NBA games, watched so many NBA games, and when you're on that court, or, you know, any game, basically, in Europe, in EuroLeague, you step on that court in a jersey, and you're thinking, every single person in this arena is watching me. They're watching me. And that's the mindset you have. It's like, you're on the spotlight, you're on the stage, and then for the first time ever in January, now, a couple of months ago, I went to my first NBA game as a fan. And I had, you know, thanks to the MBPA, I had fantastic seats in the Madison Square Garden for a game. I think New York played the Washington Wizards. So it was just, you know, regular season game, January, nothing too exciting. And I had VIP seats, you know, in a club, in a Madison club. There was not a single person watching a game. When I say there were like hundreds of people, hundreds and hundreds of people there. Not a single person watching the game. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, how is this even possible? Like, what, you know, how arrogant was I to think like everyone is watching us? No, like, people come there, they network, they talk about business, they explore different opportunities, they open up different, you know, chances for themselves, they meet interesting people, and they talk, you know, whatever, life, business, basketball. And then you watch 10 or 15% of the game, honestly.
If the game is close, you watch the end of it.
If the game is close. So I was there with my friend, and I'm telling him as we're there, I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, how is this even possible? How did I not see this when I was a player? And you get a completely different perspective on the NBA and on the business side of it and on life in general, because you realize, like, okay, you know, players are really not that important. Yeah, everything revolves around them, but, you know, the business side of it is just so much bigger, and people go to NBA games for, you know, as a release, as an outlet, as an entertainment, any game in life. I mean, football in Europe, soccer, whatever, you know, you go for different reasons. And then, it just opened up a whole new perspective for me, thinking like, okay, you know, me as a player and me as a businessman is just two different perspectives.
Yeah, I'm sure it's another humbling experience. It's very good. Are you ready for my ATOs?
Yeah. What are those?
All right. I'm not drawing up plays. I'm gonna draw up questions that you're gonna have to answer with the first thing that comes to mind, or first situation that comes to mind, first country that comes to mind. What's on top of your bucket list for traveling?
Japan.
Biggest sliding door moment in your life it could have taken you a completely different way in your career?
A moment when I'm walking in the Indiana Pacers practice facility and I'm by myself, and there's 30 executives there and Larry Bird sitting in a chair waiting for my workout, and, you know, 12 coaches on the floor. So, you know, normally when you do an NBA workout, you do it with like 5 or 6 different guys, and there's someone there, and you can always kind of tie your shoelace or get some water. Like this, I was walking into that arena by myself, you know, all eyes on me, literally. And it was a make it or break it moment for me to make it into the NBA. And that was the workout that changed my life.
Imagine you have a box of everything that you've lost in your life, just imaginary hypothetical box that you've lost in your life, what's the first thing you look for?
Ooh, phenomenal question, man. Wow. Things I lost in life, and not just objects, right? We're talking about emotions, thoughts, time.
Yes.
Oh man, I wish I would have spent a little more time with my family. My mother, my father, my brother. I mean, I was just away for so long and so much, and it felt like my parents really grew old, before I knew it. And, you know, thank God they're alive and well now. But, you know, my career just took me all around the world and I live abroad for so long. So maybe first thing I would dig into that box and trying to find some more time, some quality time with my family.
That's a cool answer. Advice for players going into retirement.
Give yourself time. Stay patient with yourself. Definitely. No change comes overnight. So, you know, you're not going to just shape shift from one lifestyle to another in 1 week. You know, it's a process that takes 1, 2, 3 years. I really talk to a lot of guys, a lot of psychiatrists, a lot of psychologists, a lot of former players. As I knew I was entering my last year of my career, I called up 5 or 6 guys that are retired and I asked them the same thing. I literally did my homework. I was like, all right, what was it like for you the first week? What was it like for you the first year? What were the challenges? So you can kind of, you know, you can prepare yourself to an extent and you can do that. And I would say not to worry yourself too much with dual career, because that's a thing now. Like, oh, you have to be ready for your second career before your first one is over. I'm definitely not all up for that. I think once you stop playing, you can start setting yourself up. Obviously, you know, it's a question of how much money you made. You know, whether you can afford to kind of have that year off to figure out what you want to do. My first advice would be stay patient and give yourself time. It's a healing process and it's a process that doesn't happen overnight.
Advice from your current self to your younger self.
Don't change a thing. Don't change a thing. Literally, everything happens for a reason. And, you know, my career was one step up and two steps back the whole time. I would think I made it and then I fell off and then I had to struggle to get back up. So it was really like, you know, the ups and downs of my careers were crazy. But looking in hindsight, everything led me to where I needed to be. So, you know, maybe I would tell myself, relax and enjoy a little more. You know, I was really stressed out over making it. And you're always like that as a player. You're like, oh, you know, I have to prove myself. I have to score all the points. I can't make mistakes. Maybe, you know, advice would be do everything the same, but try to relax a little more.
And my Tim Ferriss question that I ask everybody, your favorite failure from your career that you feel like you failed at, but you kind of glad that you failed at that, it taught you something that you wouldn't have learned otherwise.
Well, my favorite failure was my first professional experience. I failed really drastically to start my career off. My first job was in Telindus Ostende, and I was 18 years old. I was a kid going from Croatia to play to Belgium, and I signed a 4-year deal. And, you know, I was hoping that was going to be my stepping stone toward the big teams. I said, okay, Belgium league is, I would say, mid-level. It's not the strongest league in Europe. I'm going to go there. I'm going to crush it for a year and a half, 2 years, and then I'm going to go to Barcelona. That was my mindset. And then I ended up riding the bench for 2 years and not playing. And it was a major failure, and it led me to everything I needed to know about professionalism, because that was my introduction to professionalism. It's like, okay, it's not cute anymore. You're not just a kid playing for yourself and trying to entertain a crowd and score the points. This is professionalism. People get paid money to do this, and they feed their families. There's a janitor in this gym that is making money because of this team. So that's, I think, a failure that led me to realizing what professionalism is. And I'm forever thankful for that experience. But that was a big, big failure. And I was very crushed for, you know, think you're an 18-year-old kid and you don't play for 2 years. So in my formative years, which is a transition from juniors, from under 20, you know, under 18 to professionalism, I sat on the bench. So those 2 years I lost in a basketball sense, but I learned a lot in a professional sense and as a human being.
All right. Very well. Damian, thank you very much. It's been a blast. It's been a very fluid conversation. I'd say I was trying not to stick to the script because I had some topics prepared, but I felt like we were really going with the flow, and it was really good. It was really, really easygoing and a lighthearted conversation. Thank you very much.
It was. Thank you so much for inviting me. I was expecting a lot more questions on the legends of the Lithuanian basketball. I had so many Lithuanian teammates, opponents, played against so many Lithuanian teams. Obviously, tremendous respect for you know, Lithuanian school of basketball. I was actually trying to gather them all in my mind as I was preparing for the podcast.
So what's your favorite one? What's your favorite one?
Oh man, I loved watching Šiškauskas play. I loved watching him play. I played against Jonas Mačiulis my whole life, ever since we were kids, a guy I have tremendous respect for. Martinas Pocius is a dear friend of mine. Played against him so many times, also a part of my generation. So we played against each other so many times in, you know, the championships and then in the ACB. Montejunas is a friend as well. Always admire watching him play. But, you know, I was fortunate enough to catch a couple of different generations of Lithuanian basketball, you know, going from Šiškauskas and Kaukenas all the way to the young guys and to, you know, the new generations. Tremendous players, you know, even in younger generations, you could tell, you know, Lithuanians always, they were always a top matchup for us. Krepšins.
That's cool. I'm going to have to talk more about that when we meet in person. I hope that our paths will cross sooner than later.
I'm sure they will. I'm inviting you to come to Croatia.
I'll be there. I promise.
Okay.
All right, Damian. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for being here, and see you soon. Peace.
Peace.